the lambda 5-4 theory, which is technically, well, it's the simplest example. So suppose that we have the Hamiltonian that is 1/2 p squared, or we call it pi, I think, plus 1/2 gradient phi squared plus 1/2 m squared phi squared, and then plus lambda divided by 4 factorial phi to the 4. And then this part we call h0. And this h interaction. And we want to do perturbation theory in this term. So in this lecture and in the next one, we will do a lot of calculations. But well, first we need to decide what we want to compute. And usually in perturbation theory, we want to calculate energy levels, their splitting, shifting, et cetera, et cetera. But here, this formulation is not very useful for a variety of reasons. And one of the reasons is that the spectrum is continuous. If you think about any field theory, then it's clear that the spectrum is continuous because the free spectrum is that of particles, and particle can have arbitrary energy starting from the rest energy to up to infinity. And then we can have multi-particle states, so it's not discrete. And moreover, it's very, very degenerate. So one of the features is of the spectrum that it's continuous. And very degenerate. So let me illustrate the latter point. So suppose we look at a two-particle state, say, of two particles with momenta p1 and p2. And so this state will be degenerate with a state with other momenta if the energies of particles in the initial state add up to the same as energies in the final state. Right? Moreover, if the momentum in this state and this state are the same, the states will mix. There is nothing prevents them to be to combine together under perturbation. So if in addition p1 plus p2 equals to q1 plus q2, then the states will mix. And so the true state will be some linear superposition of the state. So if you start, say, in the leading order of perturbation theory with one state, then perturb it, the true physical state of the interacting Hamiltonian will be a linear superposition. So in principle, with some coefficients, but Well, let us normalize it that way. So what does this mean physically? Well, this state describes two particles moving with momentum, with given momenta. So mixing with the state that where particles have different momentum, but such that the total energy and momentum is conserved, means that these particles scattered, so they collided, and then they scattered into a new state. So let me see. The total moment should be conserved. So picture should look something like that. So there was some event, scattering event described by interactions. This coefficient here is naturally interpreted as scattering amplitude. Of particles that collided and then scattered. Yes. Yes. Oh, well, because so the philosophy of perturbation theory is that we first diagonalize the free Hamiltonian and then consider the rest as smooth perturbation. So to the leading order, the Hamiltonian is diagonalized by creation annihilation operators. And so the Hilbert space is the Fock space. So each state is a state with fixed number of particles having certain momentum. So I'm trying to visualize how this picture will change under interactions. And so obviously, this is one way in which it can change. Then, so let's try to see what is the term in the interaction Hamiltonian responsible for the scattering process. And we can immediately see that this term is indeed present. So phi itself is a linear combination of creation and annihilation operators with some coefficients. So the coefficients at the moment doesn't matter. So if you substitute, so suppose we use the same expression for phi that diagonalized the free Hamiltonian, and then substitute it into H int, then we will have a bunch of terms. In particular, we will have terms like that, right? So, and this is precisely the term that is responsible for interaction between two particles. You can think of, say, second quantized Hamiltonian, which we studied in the first lecture, where these quartic terms of this type arose from, the two-body interaction energy. So this term describes interaction between particles. However, this is not the only term that appears. There will be terms like a dagger, and a bunch of other terms. And so this term in particular describes something else. So if you look how this term acts on the state with, say, n particles, it kills two particles and then adds two different particles in principle. So it is well suited to produce this term when acting on that, this state when acting on this state. Okay? So it removes two particles with momentum p1 and p2, and then puts in particles with different momentum. Now this term will eliminate one particle and then replace it by three others. So what it describes pair creation. So in quantum field theory, particle number need not be conserved unless it's forbidden by conservation laws of charge and energy and momentum. And so this will describe particle creation. So one particle, in this case, decays into three particles. Now, the last term seems to be a little bit weird. So it just adds four particles without destroying anything. So in particular, this term will not annihilate the ground state. So if we act on the absolutely empty state, then this term will not annihilate it anymore. And so this means that the empty state is not the eigenstate of the Hamiltonian if we add interactions. Because of the pair creation, and so the true ground state contains, well, infinitely many virtual particles. So states with different number of particles can mix, and the ground state is a complicated mixture of such states. So in conclusion, the true ground state and it is not, the true ground state is some state that is not diagonal on the Fock basis, so it contains different number of particles, the linear combination of states with different number of particles. And that is not the empty state in UN. So how do we circumvent these difficulties? Well, let me, so there are two tricks basically to deal with this. And these tricks are not specific to, well, quantum field theory. What I'm going to talk about, it applies to any quantum mechanical system, particle in a potential well, hydrogen atom, whatever. But they are simply the methods that are not that complicated also work. So it's typically these methods are not taught in quantum mechanics courses. So they are really useful in systems where the number of particles is large or variable, like in quantum field theory. But in principle, they are generic. So let me start with with a trick that allows to somehow to deal with the true ground state without knowing what it is. Or to that matter, to deal with any state of the exact eigenstate of the Hamiltonian without really computing what it is. So suppose that we want to compute some expectation value, some matrix element. So if we take some operator, and we want to compute its ground state expectation value. Now, in general, to do this, we need to know what is the ground state. So normally in textbook quantum mechanics, we would do perturbation theory on omega, so we'll compute what is, say, linear correction in lambda to omega, what is the next leading order correction, then substitute this here, and take matrix elements with various eigenstates of the free Hamiltonian. So we can always express the perturbed states in terms of the unperturbed states. But there is a trick that allows to to avoid dealing with that. And so the trick is, related. So we should concentrate on time evolution. So my claim is that if we take an arbitrary state, important is that it has non-zero overlap with the true ground state, and then evolve it for sufficiently long time, then with the help of some trick, we can pick up the contribution only from the ground state. So suppose that we consider time evolution of some state, that has non-zero overlap with the vacuum. So as such state, we can take the unperturbed ground state, in this particular case, the empty state. Because if you assume that perturbation is small, then of course it cannot bring us too far from the original state when we take into account all perturbations. So the overlap will be at least non-zero. So then let us start with the empty state, which is not really the vacuum, and the void. For time t. So what we will get is, okay, so the evolution operator is simply minus IH times t, and then we act on this state. So as usual, we can expand this state into the eigenstates of H. So we can write this as e to the minus IH t, and then we expand the state in the complete basis of states, which are eigenstates of H. So let me write the ground state contribution separately. And then I can, I know how Hamiltonian acts on all of these states. So this, they're all its eigenvalues. So this will produce, they will produce some oscillating exponentials.
You only need of that. I think you have.
Oh, yes. So let me now, for simplicity, assume that the ground state energy is zero. We can always normalize energy such that we measure energies from the energy of the ground state. So then this will be zero. We assume that the vacuum energy is zero. Yes?
Is it really the vacuum energy, or is it the ground state energy?
Yes, I will not distinguish the two. So vacuum energy will be, vacuum is the ground state. So then, then we will do the trick. So we take T and add a little negative imaginary part. So we say that T is equal to 1 minus I epsilon times T. Okay? Yes?
When you set T back and equal 0.
Sorry?
When you set T back and equal 0, how does this theorem goes to zero? We will just ignore this theorem.
Equals to one. Sorry. And then what happens is that you see that these oscillating exponentials, they become exponentially suppressed. So then e to the minus I e n t will go to e to the minus I e n t minus epsilon e n t. And if you take t to infinity, then this will go to zero. So it's enough to add a little epsilon to our evolution time, and then send this evolution time to infinity, and then all of these terms will go to zero. So then, as time goes by, the only remaining state will be the ground state. Okay, up to some factor that's just the weight with which the true ground state appears in the our reference state with which we start. So we can always pick up the correct ground state from any state just by evolving it in time and making time a little bit complex. So this means that really time now lives in the complex plane, and we evolve along the line that goes that is tilted through a small angle with respect to the real axis, right? So this is angle order epsilon, and this is really the line along to which we want to evolve the system. So this is just a mathematical trick. But then we will always keep in mind that we use it. So when we will compute expectation values of some operators, we can always regard them as expectation values of in just the Fock vacuum, I mean the empty state. But then we need to evolve this state for a sufficiently long time to bring it to the, I mean, to project out all the states except for the vacuum. Okay, so this was Trick number one. No, trick number two.
Question. Before you go.
Yes.
Before you go to trick number two, I didn't understand why. What is the use of this one minus I epsilon? It's the last line in the second word.
This line?
Yeah. Before this line, your left. Yeah. Why did you set t equals to one minus I epsilon?
Regularizes the whole expression, so it goes to zero at t equals to
infinity. I choose it precisely for the reason that I want these exponentials to go to zero. So this is the trick. If I choose t to be a little bit, to have a small imaginary part, then well, I achieve my goal. So that all the jump will go and the only state will remain that will survive is the true ground state. So the importance of this is that it doesn't matter with which state I start, right? So if I evolve it for sufficiently long time, I will end up with the one. Now the second trick is known as interaction representation. Namely, since the spectrum is so degenerate and it is continuous, what the problem that I mean we really want to study is some perturbation theory in the continuous spectrum, and this is a little bit tricky from the usual quantum mechanical point of view. So the most natural object to concentrate is the evolution operator. Then we want to study evolution of the system in time. And well, in usual quantum mechanics, if you have perturbation theory in the continuous spectrum, then what we use is the Fermi's golden rule, so that describes the probability for the system to jump to some other state in per unit time, right? So we effectively we study evolution of the system in time and compute some probabilities for it to go into some other state. So here we also should concentrate on the evolution, and in fact, what we'll would like to do is to write down perturbation theory for the evolution operator. For that, to facilitate this, it's convenient to factor out the free evolution. So we want to consider operators. So suppose we have an operator O, then we define this operator in the interaction picture by conjugating it with the evolution operator of the free Hamiltonian. So it becomes H0T, then the Schrodinger operator, and then H. So without perturbation, this would be just the Heisenberg operator of the. So operators in the interaction picture are just Heisenberg operators of the free Hamiltonian. Right? Now, a little bit unusual feature of interaction representation is that Hamiltonian in this picture depends on time. So I put this in parentheses because of full Hamiltonian just by definition does not depend on time, on physical time. But this is not real. I mean, the transition to the interaction representation doesn't take into account interactions. So it evolves in time but using the free Hamiltonian. So really operators that do not depend on time, they, okay, so they acquire time dependence in this fake sense that because we evolved them not with the full Hamiltonian, but just with the, with part of it. So in particular, the interaction part of the Hamiltonian in the interaction picture will be some time-dependent operator that we will call HI of t. And well, we can also define the evolution operator in the interaction picture. So usually the evolution operator is just e to the I ht, but now we want to conjugate it with the free Hamiltonian. So this will be equal to e h0 t u of t minus t prime. Minus I h zero of the prime. So this operator plays the same role as the evolution operator. I mean, as u, but so the evolution operator you may think of it as the unitary transformation that either it, so if it acts on states, then it is just describes how they evolve in time. Or if it acts on operators, that then it transforms them from the Schrodinger representation to the Heisenberg representation. Now, this operator transforms operators from the direction representation to Heisenberg representation. So in some sense, we go into the Heisenberg representation in two steps. So first, we go into the interaction picture by conjugating with the free Hamiltonian. And then as a next step, we go into the full Heisenberg representation of the interacting Hamiltonian by conjugating with this evolution operator here. And well, the utility of this trick is that usually we know how, we know quite a lot about the free Hamiltonian, so we can transform any operator into the their interaction picture in no time, just because the free Hamiltonian is simple. And then all the complexity sits in the transition from interaction picture to the Heisenberg representation. So the key point is how to compute this evolution operator in the interaction picture. And so let me find the solution of this problem. So I will describe how to do it in detail. For the rest, I will skip certain steps later, but now let me do the derivation step by step. So as usual, the evolution operator satisfies the time-dependent Schrodinger equation. and the direction picture evolution operator is not an exception, so it satisfies the independent Schrödinger equation with the interaction Hamiltonian, which you can easily derive by differentiating this equation in time. So this is the Schrödinger equation. And the initial condition is that if the evolution in zero time is trivial. So how to solve this equation? Well, the complication here is that the Hamiltonian depends on time, right? So it's by itself, it is a time-dependent operator. And this equation appears quite often in mathematical physics. So let me describe in detail how to solve it. So not only in this context, but let's say in gauge theories, it plays an important role. So let us try to solve it. Well, in some approximation. So we cannot solve it exactly for any h, but we can solve it using iterations. So as a trivial approximation, we can take just the initial condition, right? So it will be if. So the key point here is that the interaction Hamiltonian is small. So we assume that we can do perturbation theory, and the interaction part of the Hamiltonian is, the part of the Hamiltonian that we consider to be a small perturbation. So to the leading order, we can regard this as just zero, and then this will be a solution. And so we can start with it and then build iterations. So to do this, we can write this as an integral equation. So we can write that u initial of t t prime is equal to 1. Let me see, minus I integral from t prime to t t tau h interaction tau u interaction of tau t prime. So what I did is I just integrated the left and the right hand sides from t prime to t, and then multiply by I. So the left hand side will be the evolution operator at time t minus evolution operator at t prime, which is 1. And the right hand side I have to leave as an integral because I don't know how to integrate it. But you see this term is small, so we can solve this integral equation by iterations. So the zeroth iteration is that u is equal to 1. And then I substituted back into the right-hand side. And so use here this zeroth iteration to get the first iteration. So in the first step, what I get is that this will be equal to 1 minus I integral from t prime to t. G, and then let me rename the integration variable from tau to t1. Okay? So I just replace this by 1. And so this will give me the first iteration of the solution. And then I take this and again substitute to the right hand side. So then I get the second iteration. And so on, but let me see so what happens in the second iteration step. So I get these two terms. And then there will be plus minus I squared integral from t prime to t dt 1. And then there will be an integral from t prime to t1 of h interaction T1, each interaction T2. Okay? So this is just the result of substitution of the first iteration into the equation. What happened is that I just added this term here, and so this brings in the nested integral where the second integration ranges from 0.1 to so from the initial time to the first point here. So if this is the time axis, this is t prime, this is t, so t1 is here, and then t2 should go from t prime to t1. So then I substitute it again here. Then I get the third iteration. And you may guess what will be the answer. So the answer will be nested integral with three integrations. In fact, it is easy to guess what will be the general formula. So the exact solution can be written as a series of nested integrals where each next integration goes from t prime to the previous integration point. Right, so now I integrate over n points in the nth term. So the first integration run along the whole interval. The second runs from t prime to t1, and so on. So all these points are ordered along our time order. So so we get the solution as a formal series of these nested integrals. Of course, computing these integrals depends on what really HI is. So once we know it depends on some time, we can really do a calculation of all of these integrals. And certainly we know one case in which this should be possible to do. Namely, suppose that interaction Hamiltonian commutes with the original Hamiltonian, right? So if it commutes, we can diagonalize it in the same basis, and then we don't need to do any of these complicated tricks. So then we know that the evolution operator should be a simple exponential. So in this case, of course, the interaction Hamiltonian does not depend on time because it commutes with H0. And then we know the answer. The answer should be some exponential. So the question is, can we always write this as an exponential? And the answer is yes. But it's not the usual exponential. It's exponential that takes into account non-commutativity of operators at different times. And this is called time order exponential. So to to bring this into a nice form, we can introduce an operation of time ordering, which is really important in quantum field theory. So suppose you have two operators that depend on time. This can be Heisenberg operators or interaction picture operators. Let's define their time ordered product. That will denote by the letter T written in front of the operators. It's an ordinary product, but we should take the order of operators such that the argument grows from right to left. Okay, so it will be O1, T1, O2, T2 if T1 is larger than T2, and vice versa if the arguments are stand in different order of time. Okay. So this is just the definition. It prescribes us that we should put operators in particular, so multiply them in particular order, depending on their arguments. It can be generalized to an arbitrary number of operators. So just it's important that they just depend on time as a single variable. So if you have 20 operators, their time product is such that you take them in the order of, if you read from left to right, in the order of diminishing time. And this is precisely how the operators in the evolution operator appear. So they appear in the time ordered way. So we can, what we can do is, well, we can just, so the point is that we cannot write this. So suppose that H does not depend on T. Then we know that we should be able to write this formula as an exponential. So there is a little, again, a small mathematical trick involved. Exponential, of course, has 1 over n factorial in its Taylor expansion. Now, it doesn't seem that there is 1 over n factorial in this formula, right? It doesn't look as an expansion, an exponential. The way it arises is that, OK, so suppose that h does not depend on time, right? That then we can pull h out of the integral. So we just need to do this nested integral with weight 1. So I claim that this is the result is t minus t prime to the n divided by n factorial. Can you see this immediately from this formula? What? Yes.
How can we assume that Hi it doesn't depend on t?
Well, this is in this particular case where H interaction commutes with H0, which is completely uninteresting. But just for the sake of the argument, in this case, we should reproduce just e to the I H t minus t prime. So let's check that it works. So which is not absolutely obvious and relies on this equation. So if you wanted to
answer.
So I mean,
do you mean the sum is equal to that?
No, this is just one integral. So please raise hand for whom this is completely obvious. Wow, it's so maybe someone can explain how it works.
Change variable of integration. So
to what?
The easy way to see this is to change the variables of integration from always go to t, and do it for the case of 1 and 2, and then prove it for x0 n using induction.
Well, but you are getting powers, and every time you integrate the power, you get the power down. So you get, when you integrate it one time, you get 1. Then if you have t minus t to the second, you get a 2, and then you get this until n.
OK, yes, it's so.
Still
not clear.
Oh, it's possible to do it by induction and prove the base and prove the one step and so.
Well, that's what I said.
Yes. Yeah. So for me,
if
it would be.
The first two or three, then
yeah. Let's do just that. So let's do first two cases. So if n equals 1. This is obvious. And then for n equals 2, let me do it the way that you said. So it's if this is t1, this is t2, then t1 goes from t prime to t. But T2 should be smaller than T1. So if you draw a diagonal, the region of integration is this. So the result will be the area of this square divided by 2. So this gives 1/2 times the area, which is T minus T prime divided by 2. Now, for n equals 3,
we just integrate this expression over.
Yes, so one can do that, but I want to give an explanation that is sort of geometric based on this picture. So let me try to. I'm afraid the picture will come out. So come out bad, but anyway, so there is a cube, right? Whose volume is T cube, T minus T prime cube. But we want to integrate, so we want to say that so one of the integration variables is smaller than the other, and the third is smaller than the other two. So there will be some. Yes, so it will be difficult for me to draw. So there will be some cell inside this cube where, so this is T1, T2, T3. So I want to keep the cell. So we need to compute the volume of the cell. Where T1 is smaller than, or is larger than T2, is larger than T3. Okay? Now, what is the volume of the cell? Well, my claim is that the volume of the cell is 1 over 3 factorial multiplied by the volume of the cube. Geometrically, it's not very easy to see, but with a bit of algebra, you can easily. Yes.
And we can say that like volumes of such cells, they are all the same because variables are like symmetric. So, and the number of cells is n factorial.
Yes, that's the way to see it. So, you just you can reorder these variables, right? So, we can decompose this cube onto 6 cells corresponding to permutations of TIs. So there will be a cell in which T2 is larger than T1, larger than T3. It does not intersect with this cell. Its volume is the same. Then there will be a cell where they are ordered in another possible way. So in the number of possibilities is the number of permutation of 3 objects, which is 3 factorial. And so from now on, it should be clear what happens when n is arbitrary. Right? You'll have some hypercube whose volume is t minus t prime to the n. And then there will be n factorial cells where the integration variables are ordered. So indeed, this if h is a time-independent variable, integration produces 1 over n factorial, and everything combines into the exponential. But with this trick, we can even do this exponentiation for arbitrary operators. Because now we can, so the idea is that we replace integration over one cell by integration of the whole cube. But each time we integrate, we should time order the operators. So we, in another way, we instead of relabeling variables, or so instead of imposing some condition of integration variables, each time we go from one cell to another cell, we just reorder the operator. So let me write it. Maybe it will become more clear. So another claim is that ui of t prime can be written as sum from 0 to infinity minus I to the n. And here I should divide by n factorial, but integrate over the whole cube. But here I put t ordered product. T1 hi tm. Right? So by introducing t ordered, the operation of t-ordering, I can mimic this trivial calculation where the weight was equal to 1. So this will be, I can decompose again the integration over all n factorial cells, but the contribution of each cell will be the same because of t-ordering. And then if I divide by n factorial, I avoid multiple counting. And then I can take t, the operator t, out of the sum. And what will remain is just an exponential. So there is a very compact way of representing the answer. It's just to write that this is t ordered exponential. X minus I. Yes.
How did you change the endpoints and you put the set factorial using the time ordering operator?
Well, because you see, so suppose let's do it for 2 points, right? So we have this integral that should go over this cell. And so here we should integrate, so this is T1 and T2. So we should integrate what? Hi of T1, Hi of T2 over the cell. Right? Well, this is according to the formula written upstairs. Now we have added an integral over this cell of Hi T2 times Hi of T1. So in this, so if we put time ordering, then in this cell the time order product will be ordinary product in this order, and in this cell it should be taken in that order. Okay, and then the integral over this cell of that product is just the same as the integral, the original integral. So if you divide by 2, we don't double count. And so we can write this as an exponential, but this time ordering implied. So this time ordering trick is it's a little bit formal. We still should always understand this two-ordered exponential as an infinite sum. And in this infinite sum, the operators should be multiplied in the order prescribed by their time positions. Okay, but it gives at least the formal answer for the evolution operator. So
then you have a plus in the interaction.
Sorry?
So it's just, I mean, shouldn't be plus lambda over.
Plus.
Well,
does it
matter?
But we... Signs are important.
Yeah.
I mean, if you make a mistake in science, you better do it twice.
Mm-hmm.
If you do it just once, it's... So here are two tricks. So the one trick is that we evolve the group. I mean, we can deal with the with whatever state we like. For instance, with the empty state, treat it as if it were vacuum, but then evolve it in time for infinitely long. For instance, the long time, and then tilt the contour in the complex plane, and then we can go into the interaction representation, in which we have a relatively compact expression for the evolution operator. Okay, so all of this can be applied to field theory. So we can, for instance, we can go into the interaction representation. In field theory. So basically what we do is we say that our field in the interaction representation is evolved with time according to the free Hamiltonian, starting with the Schrödinger field, with field operator in the Schrödinger representation. And then we get some operator that we'll call phi I. And for this operator, we have a very nice Lorentz invariant expression, because this is nothing but Heisenberg field of the free Hamiltonian, which is just an integral over all oscillators. So for this phi I, we can use the old expression that we got by quantizing the free field. So it's just a sum over, this is the integral over momenta, then the delta function of pi squared minus m squared, square root of 2 pi 0. And then oscillator. So it's some linear combination of oscillators. The interaction Hamiltonian is the integral of this over the whole space. And now, important point here is that in this formula, we managed to write everything as the whole over the as an integral of the interaction Hamiltonian over the whole evolution period of time. So, if we study evolution from, say, very far in the past to very far in the future, this integral will span the whole timeline, right, from minus infinity to plus infinity. And this will combine into a four-dimensional integral here, right? So the total exponent in the evolution operator will then be a four-dimensional integral, which will be, which will be manifestly Lorentz invariant. So this equation is manifestly Lorentz invariant. And then by doing this trick with two-ordered exponentials, we can write the evolution operator in a manifestly Lorentz invariant way. As long as we study evolution from minus infinity to plus infinity. So, of course, the this is not completely in our hands. It depends on what problem we study. And so, in particular, this means that evolution during fixed and finite period of time in quantum field theory is difficult. So usually, we don't study, these processes that take some fixed particular period of time. Because theoretically, it's difficult, and for practical questions that we want to answer usually do not involve such type of questions. Because, for instance, if you want to compute some, probability of some particle collision process, say some accelerator experiment, then of course times involved there are much, much longer than the characteristic time scales of particle interactions. So we can safely, ignore that, the duration of the particle bunch that collide target is finite because it is definitely much, much longer than any interaction times involved that times that involved in each particular collision. So we can simply take an approximation that the length of the bunch is infinite, and then we can study evolution in infinite time. And so this immensely simplifies the formalism, and we will always deal with the situations where we can consider our time and the evolution period of time to be infinite. So 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 we'll be just dealing with quantities that are, well, in some sense, easy, I mean, which are defined in such a way that they are easy to calculate. And as happens many times in physics, these are also the quantities that contain enough information to reconstruct all necessary physical observables. So as such quantities, we will take the Green's functions. So Green's function is a vacuum expectation value of a product of Heisenberg operators. And this product is taken, so the operators in the Green's function are taken to be time ordered. So this is just the definition. The reason why we consider time-ordered products is just because they are well suited for application of perturbation theory. Because, okay, so the evolution operator is naturally time-ordered.